24th, 1961, Western Australia's worst bushfire disaster raged through and around Dwellingup in the state's southwest. Three towns were burnt to the ground, and over 1 million acres of forest and bushland was incinerated. It was a terrifying night. The fire swept through Dwellingup and Holyoake and roared off to the south, where the town of Nanga Brook was also destroyed. When dawn broke, the survivors were greeted by a terrible scene. One of those to record his observations was schoolteacher John McCoy, who had grown up in Dwellingup and was now living in Perth. But his parents were still living in Dwellingup, and hearing the news that the town was threatened, he had rushed to the area. With enormous difficulty, he and two others fought their way into town along the road from Pinjarra. He recalled,
"About 2 kilometres out of Dwellingup, we started coming across burnt-out vehicles. They appeared to have been abandoned on the road as people started to leave town and then were forced to retreat. There were a number of vehicles in the straight, tree-lined avenue just out of Dwellingup. We stopped and checked each burnt-out hulk, concerned that we would find corpses. There were none. And only later did we find out that no person was killed by the fire. It was just before dawn as we drove into Dwellingup. It was as if a bomb had directly hit the town. Most of the buildings were rendered into piles of ashes, with the only prominent remnants being the brick chimneys and stacks of tangled, twisted, corrugated iron sheeting."
The biggest problem for the firefighters and survivors was smoke-damaged eyes. This was coupled to shock and exhaustion. Most of the smoke-blind firefighters were evacuated to Pinjarra, and here some fearsome scenes were enacted. Josephine Holland, wife of Forest Officer Arthur Dutchie Holland, had been in Perth on that fateful Tuesday and was returning to Dwellingup but could not get through. She and others were marooned overnight in Pinjarra, almost paralysed with anxiety.
"There were no communications with Dwellingup. Later we heard that Mrs. Lynn, the Dwellingup postmistress, had phoned the Pinjarra post office and called for help, and then all of a sudden her line went dead. All the women became very frightened, as it was still unknown where our families and husbands were. Morning eventually came, and we had word that men were starting to come into the Pinjarra hospital from Dwellingup. I drove straight to the hospital, where the first thing I saw were silent, blackened men with white bandages over their eyes, laid out in lines on the lawn under the trees. I walked up and down the lines looking for Arthur. After a while, I found him. He looked terrible. I thought he was dead, but he was just exhausted and temporarily blinded, the result of the drops inserted by the nurses into eyes burnt by the smoke and heat. After a little while, I was given permission by the doctor to take Arthur with me. We were billeted at the house of the Pinjarra baker. Arthur didn't make it to bed. He simply lay down on the floor and fell asleep."
There were many stories of heartbreak. Mrs. Rona Gibbings was aged 29 at the time of the fires, living with her husband Tom and 3 small children on a farm just out of Dwellingup. They had purchased the butcher shop in town and had plans to supply the shop from the stock raised on their farm. Rona recalls,
"We had heard that there were some bushfires around, but were so isolated on the farm that we didn't really know how bad things were. About 5 o'clock on the afternoon of the 24th of January, we drove into town as I wanted to find my parents. We had no telephone on the farm. I got through to my parents, who lived in Subiaco, and asked them to come down and meet me in Pinjarra on the 25th and take the children back to Perth. Tom and I wanted to make the house and farm safe should the fire make it to Dwellingup and further south, but we didn't want the kids around if this happened. I soon learnt that a crisis was close at hand. Most of the menfolk were out of the fires and the town of Bankshiredale was under severe threat. Tom decided he would stay in Dwelling Up to try and save our butcher shop as the fire had reached the outskirts of town. We said our goodbyes and I climbed back in the van to return to the farm to collect clothes. Driving through town on McLeody Street, I could see that the fire would reach town at any minute. Already burning embers were falling and 44-gallon fuel drums at the fuel depot were starting to explode due to the heat. We reached the turn off to Gibbings Road and got about half a mile down the road when I stopped the van. There was a tongue of fire that had bypassed the town to the west and it caught up with us. Fireballs were flying past us and igniting the trees ahead and above us. Well, I turned the van around and we headed for Pinjarra. I pulled into the Pinjarra Hotel. I walked into the bar. It was the first time I'd ever been in a bar. And asked the men if they knew that Dwelling Up was on fire. They came outside and we could all see the red glow in the sky. One of the men took us to the hall in Pinjarra and we were bedded down for the night. And meanwhile, I met up with my parents who had decided to drive down from Subiaco that evening rather than wait until the next day. Mum and Dad and I walked the streets of Pinjarra for the rest of the night. And the next morning I was determined to get back to Dwelling Up as I didn't know how Tom was and, well, he didn't know where we were. And in the end, I couldn't let my parents take the children away with them. I just needed them close to me. We eventually got back to Dwelling Up. It was a very slow trip as we had to dodge potholes caused through tree roots being burnt out from under the bitumen and the road collapsing. There was debris all over the road. I had to explain who I was to the people who were manning the roadblock, well, they were already turning back sightseers. I eventually found Tob. He was at the hotel, which had been converted to the first aid post. He was having treatment for his damaged eyes. He told us that our butcher shop had been burned to the ground. A few weeks later, Tom and I and the kids went back to the farm. As we stood on the hill and looked down over the property, we could see the destruction. The buildings, vehicles, fences, orchard and the stock were all destroyed. And for the next 6 months, we lived in the remnants of the cow shed. Half of it was still standing. Clothes and blankets were supplied by the Salvation Army and a small amount of cash came in from the Lord Mayor's appeal. We did not get a penny from the insurance because the fire was started by lightning and the insurance people declared it an act of God. That fire changed our lives forever.
Not all of the stories from the fires were harrowing. Young Frank Caddy, then the forestry mechanic at Nanup down in the southwest, had a wonderful adventure. He was directed to drive Nanup's Mack fire truck up to the fire. And he tells an exciting story.
A message came down to Nanup that they needed our big Mack fire truck. It was urgent, they said. The police escort had been arranged. Alan Hill, the DFO at Nanup, asked me to drive it up. The department had two Mack trucks at the time. One was stationed at Dwelling Up and the other at Nanup. The Macks were 1942 vintage American-built LS-10s and had been acquired by the Forests Department from the RAAF. Where they'd been used during the war for aircraft and aerodrome firefighting. The LS-10 was designed specifically as a fire truck. It was relatively light for its size, as the object was to get to a fire in the shortest possible time. It was therefore very fast in a straight line. Its top speed was close to 100 miles per hour, 160 k's an hour. To the police escort, two constables riding BSA 650cc Golden Flash motorcycles. They set off in front of me, riding abreast and making liberal use of their sirens. However, although the motorbikes were capable of speeds up to 140 k's an hour, they were too slow for the Mack. I was right up them and holding back. As we tore through Bunbury, my police escort was starting to become uncomfortable because I was right on their back wheels. Near Waterloo, they quietly pulled aside, waved me through, let me have my head. The speed of that truck was awesome. And the driving conditions added to the thrill. It was left-hand drive. There was no cab, no doors, no seatbelts, and only a flat wooden buffboard seat. You would never be allowed on the road these days. But I did what I had to do, and made good use of the horn going through towns. Happily, there were no accidents on that mad ride. Other motorists seemed to recognise that it was an emergency and made allowances. At Harvey, I delivered the truck to a crew standing by waiting for me. As soon as it had got its breath back, the Mac was off out to the fire and put to work.
You might remember Ted Cracknell's rescue of a Major Mitchell cockatoo in a cage from an abandoned house in Holyoke. Ted recalls the end of that story.
The Major Mitchell cockatoo survived the fire. He lived with us for a while. But that bird hated me. Every time I walked past the cage, he would gnash his beak, snarl, and hurl himself at the bars in an attempt to get at me. I think he somehow held me responsible for the whole affair.
It was a great day when I was able to return him to his rightful owner.
And there were some mysteries. The young forester George Pete and some men who had gathered at the Dwelling Up pub volunteered to walk the 2 miles into Holyoke on the morning after the fire to see if anything survived. They had to walk because all the roads were blocked by fallen trees and debris. George recalled,
"The whole area was silent, blackened and glowing. The smoke was thick. As we neared Holyoke, we suddenly heard the sound of singing. Then up out of the creek rose an old fella clutching a wine flagon. He was well away. He waved the flagon towards us and walked off."
They never saw him again. Nobody ever seemed to know who that old fella was or how on earth he survived the onslaught of the fire that destroyed the town or what happened to him. John Hector was also a member of the party who walked into Holyoke that day. He remembered,
We were standing amongst the wreckage of the town when a small willy-willy went through.
The only sound was the clanging of galvanised iron.
It was eerie and frightening. The surrounding forest was totally devoid of life due to the intense heat generated by the huge fuel mass. It's hard to describe. Just a scene with no greenery, no birds, no animals and no insects. The trees with their bare black trunks were cooked rigid. All that remained of the houses was white ash. 50 years later, I can still recall this unimaginable and unforgettable sight. A scene of total devastation. The silence was deafening.
At least one story ended happily. Lionel Dobson, the engineer at the Dwelling Up sawmill, and his wife Joy, had been looking after Isla Eastcott, the 17-year-old daughter of their neighbour, Mick. Lionel had almost single-handedly saved the Dwelling Up sawmill from being burnt down and then sheltered the night in the car on the football oval. He recalled,
"When dawn came and the fire was now past, we returned to our homes. The extent of the damage was unimaginable. Most of the houses were gone. A pall of smoke hung over everything. Amazingly, our house survived, but the Eastcott house next door was completely gone. Poor Isla was heartbroken, and this was on top of her concern for her father. Mick was still with the crews who had been fighting the fire out east. There had been no word from them, and they were all feared lost. I will never forget the scene later that day. Isla was sitting on our front veranda, inconsolable with anxiety, when a grimy forestry truck pulled up and Mick climbed down. There were tears all round, I can tell you."
The return of Mick Eastcott marked the return of the firefighters who had been working on the fire east of Dwelling Up and who had become trapped when the cyclone struck. Nobody at Dwelling Up knew what had happened to these men. But thanks to the magnificent leadership of Arthur Ashcroft, who was in charge of this fire, they all survived. Arthur had gathered his crews together
and led them in convoy through the burnt ground to a spot where they could shelter for the night. Arthur recalled,
"Well, it was a long night. Smoke, ash and sparks, well, they were flying everywhere. It was very hard on the eyes and the breathing. So in the early morning, as dawn was breaking, one of the forestry men, who was an ex-soldier, was heard to even remark he'd spent better nights in Tobruk. I got everyone moving anyway, using a bulldozer to remove fallen trees, and we made our way back to Dwelling Up, arriving sort of late morning. As we entered the township, the stark realisation of the town's devastation was just mind-blowing. The convoy was greeted with sighs of relief by the fire controller, Bruce Beggs. We'd been reported missing, having ascertained that everyone for whom I was responsible was safe. I was then able to at last relax from the tension that had gripped me for so many hours. Someone put a cold glass of beer in my hands. It tasted wonderful. It tasted so wonderful that I adjourned to the bar and, well, I had a few more. With no sleep and no food for nearly 48 hours, the beers relaxed me very rapidly, let me tell you. So when I was dragged out for an interview with a Channel 7 TV team, it was not surprising that I appeared somewhat disjointed.
The aftermath of the fires demonstrated the best qualities of Australian communities. Holyoake and Nanga Brook were never rebuilt, but there was a tremendous energy and esprit de corps in Dwelling Up, and this was devoted to the rebuilding of the town and of its community spirit. The Australian bush also demonstrated its resilience, as Joe Holland recalled.
The winter rains and spring of 1961 started the renewal process in the bush. Tiny leaves appeared on the stark naked trees. Scarlet runner, white clematis, purple hovea and yellow wattles bloomed in profusion in the blackened bush. Never had we appreciated the beauty of our wildflowers more.
50 years later, Bruce Beggs summed up the conclusion of every firefighter who had been involved in the 1961 fires.
A great lesson learned from the 1961 bushfires was the need for fuel reduction burning. Without it, no force on earth can stop a forest fire on a bad day.
The lesson is a simple one. Fuel reduction burning does not prevent bushfires, but it makes them less intense and easier and safer to control. Luckily, the Australian bush loves fire and is healthier and more diverse in an environment in which there is periodic, mild intensity fire. These stories are a unique record of the human side of the great bushfires of 1961. They provide a moving insight into the first-hand emotions, the courage and the resilience of those who in various ways became caught up in the fires and have never forgotten them. The costs of the 1961 bushfires were never counted, nor has there been any estimate of the psychological damage to the people who fought the fires or those who lost everything they had worked their lives for and had to start again, or those whose hearts were broken and were unable to start again. How well one Nanga Brook woman summed this up when she was interviewed by a journalist at Waroona the morning after the fire.
What did you lose?
The journalist asked.
Everything that goes to make a home after 17 years of married life,
she replied. The fires are 60 years ago now, and over the years many things have changed. In society, in the bush, and in the growth of technology, including firefighting technology. But the fundamentals of the human spirit and the challenges it faces are unchanged. Bushfires still threaten human values and the environment, just as they did 60 years ago. Similarly, the lessons learned from the 1961 fires apply equally well today as they did 60 years ago. Most important is the lesson that Australians must prepare for fires. In the full knowledge that bushfires are inevitable, an intelligent community will take steps to minimise the potential damage and costs, not just wait helplessly and allow the fires to ride roughshod over them. We pay tribute to the courage and the spirit of the people who contributed their stories. And we remember those who were there at the time and are no longer with us. Their stories will now go unrecorded. We also thank our storytellers for their memories and for reminding us what it was like to be at the heart of a bushfire tragedy.
In Tempered by Fire, you heard Roger Underwood AM as the narrator. Roles were played by Rosemary Barr OAM, Rebecca Davis, Bernie Davis, Jenny Davis OAM, Chris Greenwood, Stuart Hallis, Oliver Hallis, Anthony Howes, Honor Yosef, and Ellen Underwood. The soundscape was created by Edo Brands. Technical producers were Carl Akers and Edo Brands. This has been a Theatre 180 production, directed by Jenny Davis, OAM.